This is The Conversation from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're bringing you the highlights from a recent town hall gathering. The forum was brought to you by Zocalo Public Square, the Daniel K. Inouye Institute, and HPR. The question we explored was, how much tourism is too much? The panelists included Frank Haas, a marketing consultant and former vice president of tourism marketing at the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Peter Apo is a cultural tourism specialist and former Office of Hawaiian Affairs trustee. Martha Honey is the executive director of the Center for Responsible Travel, who hails from Washington, D.C. And John Knox is a former president of the Hawaii Economic Association and a public policy researcher who studies tourism. Now, I've personally seen the effects of over-tourism at Diamond Head Crater. That's my personal experience. We started the conversation by asking the panelists to share an experience where they felt a little uncomfortable, where they weren't having a lot of fun, maybe because of too many tourists or too many people in places that they maybe shouldn't be. Here's Frank Haas.
I'll talk about too many people in the sense that too many people in the wild. If you've read the story in the Star Advertiser a while ago about the hippie bus that was parked by Kapi'olani Park. And as a result of that story, the guy that had this bus, it had seven berths in it. He was charging $30 a night for people there. This big story ran in the paper, and the next day he left Kapi'olani Park, but he was across the street from my house in Kailua. So I've personally seen, it's not the number of tourists, it's where they are. And across the street from my house is too many tourists.
And Martha, what about you? You've seen the world. So what are some of your experiences?
Well, I think the one I wanted to mention was Barcelona, which I went to look at last year, partly because we're doing a book on over tourism that I'm editing. And I wanted to see firsthand what's going on. And it was, in many ways, shocking, but in some ways sort of hopeful. Shocking because it's just a conglomeration of factors that have come together, sort of a perfect storm of problems that have come together in Barcelona. Too much cruise tourism, too much Airbnb or short-term rentals, too much day visitors coming in on buses, cheap airlines, and then the whole sort of selfie culture and bucket list that people want to come and just take a picture and leave. All of these kinds of tourism are not leaving much money behind in the destination, but they're filling it up to overcapacity. The good news is in Barcelona that they have now elected the first woman mayor, I think, in all of Europe, and the first mayor elected on a controlled tourism agenda. And they have a citywide effort underway to create a master plan for 2020 to control this. And we did a forum in Washington recently where we brought over their chief person who's in charge of this. And it was very interesting. I mean, multifaceted, multidimensional task force that's looking at the problem led by government. And I think one of the things I came away with was that government has to be front and center in addressing the problem, but lots and lots of stakeholders have to be involved. I really think that Barcelona and some of the other cities in around the Mediterranean in Europe are kind of the canary in the coal mine for what we're beginning to face in the U.S. and in Canada. And so it's really important to pay attention to both what they're suffering, but also how they're beginning to address it.
Okay. And Peter?
You know, one day I was going to a business meeting over on the windward side, and I had to go through Kaneohe, and I was actually heading around still on the other side of the North Shore. When I came out, it was shorter to come back this way, but I thought, well, I'll go take a look. I was an hour and 25 minutes because of the traffic that was caused at the where the people go to look for turtles. And when they removed the parking restriction there and allowed people to park and cross the street. And, you know, to sit in a car that long, you got to figure some kind of disaster happened to be that long going a few miles. When I got up to that point, I was like totally frustrated to see it was because we had to stop to let a tourist cross the street. That was my deal.
And John, what's yours?
Last summer, I took a trip around Scandinavia and came back and went through Iceland. And I was fascinated with that place because of its similarities to Hawaii. It's a little colder, but they got a whole lot of volcanoes. And they have a whole lot of tourists. Now, I was one of them. So I was not the resident being impressed by a tourist, but I was a tourist being impressed by the number of tourists there. And, of course, a whole lot of the attractions there are natural resources like us. So as we went on these roads and highways in a tour bus, I said, wow, this is a very deserted country. But I wonder what they think of us. Whether they feel deserted, because there's sure a whole lot of us when we stop at these waterfalls and glaciers. So on my last morning there, I went and talked to the Iceland Tourist Bureau research chief, and it was just, oh yeah, that's us too. So I got to be both the tourist and the resident and understand everybody's perspective there, but it was a whole lot like us.
Well, and you're a numbers guy, and, you know, we're talking 10 million visitors here, and folks are wondering, well, is this the tipping point? You know, what are some of the solutions? So if I could maybe start with you.
Sure. The question on the floor is 10 million visitors too many visitors, or how many visitors is too many visitors? And that's a very, very complicated question, but it comes with a qualification. 10 million visitors is too many visitors if it's not well managed. It's all about managing it, and I don't think we've done a very good job at it. And this comes from years of trying to really build tourism here in Hawaii. I came to Hawaii in 1980, and I can't remember how many visitors we had. That was like 3.5 million or so. And hey, bring them on. Let's do mass promotions, bring people here. So that was 38 years ago. So now here we are in 2019. It's a different world. Things have changed. And what's changed is the volume, and what the volume is dictating is that we need to create a management plan for them. How many visitors is too many? 500 visitors on Laniakea Beach is too many. 5,000 visitors on Diamond Head Trail is too many. One visitor across the street from my house is too many. But it's site-specific. These are where the pain points are, and they're pain points because we're not managing them. So John and I worked on a project back 15 years ago, the DBED asked the same question, Department of Business, how many visitors is too many visitors? And it's a little like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. And DBED said, we can't give you the answer. And they didn't have a very good reason for it, I thought. But the better reason is it depends. It depends on what kind of visitors and how you're managing them. And I'll cede the floor, but I'll be happy to talk about that more later.
So I would just say amen. I think that you're absolutely right, that it's how visitors are managed, and the whole concept of what has been called carrying capacity, which is an effort to try to determine how many visitors are the appropriate number, I think has really been debunked, and it's not worth going down that route. I mean, obviously, at some point, there are too many visitors, but it is about management and control of the visitors, and also the kind of visitors that you want. Really, one of the challenges for Hawaii is how to be capturing, rather than the tourism success being measured in increased number of visitors each year, but how much money is being left in the country, how much is being kept here. And that is trying to attract and keep high-quality visitors rather than high quantities of visitors. So it's management and the kind of visitors who are coming.
And Frank, I know you had worked on a white paper to talk about that very point, that 30 years ago, our visitors were spending more than they are today.
Yeah, in real money terms, that is inflation-adjusted terms, 1989 was a peak year for visitors, and we have just now equaled that. Mm-hmm. So between 1989 and 2019, we have about the same real economic impact, and we have about 3.5 million more visitors. So what does that mean? 3.5 million people on the trails with needs for policing, lifeguards, water, sewage, all those things that come with the increase in visitors, but about the same number of impacts. So it will come down to what kind of visitors. And the good news, and there are solutions, and these days with the improvements in technology, we can really better pinpoint the types of visitors that are higher spending in real terms and have less impact. Just as one example, corporate meetings, those visitors spend about 30% more per day than average. Honeymooners spend about 15% more per day than the average visitor. And we have a wealth of data here. We can dive into that data and find those people who are really better economic contributors to our economy and are less likely to, you know, go off in the wild and park across from my house. All those things that can affect this.
And okay, John.
Yeah, the decline in visitor spending on an average daily basis, well, it's been going on somewhat in the last 6 years. It was going on a whole lot in the 90s and the 2000s. That's when there was this huge decrease. For the first time, the official state forecasts put out by the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism project ongoing declines in daily visitor spending, even as they project ongoing increases. Our government kind of made up for that in terms of collecting the money that we need to pay for the costs by imposing the TAT and then increasing the TAT. So government has been getting more money from tourists in a way that you wouldn't expect from looking at their spending patterns. But how long can that pattern of ratcheting up taxes go on if we continue to have this pattern and even our higher spending visitors are spending less relatively than they used to? And I'm curious if Martha knows whether this is a pattern elsewhere, because we don't know.
I was going to say that our study we recently did in the Dominican Republic, which is the largest tourism market in the Caribbean, more earnings from tourism and more numbers of tourists. But in fact, the spending per tourist has been going down over the last 30 years. And there, I think it's all-inclusive resorts and cruise tourism, two problems that I think you really don't have, but I'd be curious to know, you know, what the issues are here. But I think that this is not unique to Hawaii, and it does really need to be looked at and studied. Yeah.
And Peter, I apologize. I should have started with you, because you represent our host culture here in Hawaii, and we're all visitors here. But what's your take from where you
said? I'll tell you what is unique to Hawaii. I want to read you the beginning part of a column I wrote 10 years ago. First, I'm on record as being an outspoken Native Hawaiian advocate of quality tourism. I am an advocate of quality tourism growth, with an unwavering belief that the aloha traditions, the practice of welcoming and hosting strangers to our islands, is a matter of honor and cultural dignity. Aloha defines us as a people. It's in our DNA. The words Hawaii and aloha are two of the most powerful marketing brands in the world, recognized by people living in the remotest places on Earth. Hawaiians and Hawaiian culture is the genesis from which emerged our multi-billion dollar industry, whose meteoric growth over the last three quarters of a century now represents a third of Hawaii's gross state product. And yet, hidden beneath all the success and wealth and growth as an industry, there is a buried tragic story. And that tragedy is the alienation of the Hawaiian community and their culture from the very industry they helped to create. How can it be that Hawaiians and Hawaiian culture can be so distanced from an industry that came to existence because of them? How can it be that our business model ignores the profound moral abridgment of the disconnect between the world's greatest hosting population and those who would be hosted? How can it be that Hawaiian people have become so irrelevant to the future of tourism? By any measure, right and wrong, this is wrong. Now, you can get a lot of arguments about that, but basically, the reality is that there is this love-hate relationship. The love part is because it is natural for Hawaiians and all of Hawaii to welcome visitors and to be friendly. It's the business model. And as Frank started pointing out, the management has to change.
Right. We see the headlines and we think, you know, where's the adult in the room, right? Well, we're the adults in the room. Something's got to get fixed. You know, in the Philippines, President Duterte shut down a resort island for 6 months so that the resource could heal. You know, the city has tried to manage Hanauma Bay. We've seen up on Haleakala, the National Park Service is trying to limit the number of visitors there because they only have 150 parking spaces and fights are breaking out, so they've got to go to a reservation system. So do we start to say, okay, we've got to do things like this?
We need to start doing something different. You know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. We need to do something different. It is difficult. You know, how many tourists is too many? We can't throw people off the airplane. There's this thing called the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. People have the right to come here, and we can't say no. But we can manage it by zoning, rules, regulations, taxes, fees, things like that. So we need to start looking at things we've never looked at before. We need to do that before it becomes a crisis. We have reacted in the past when it's a crisis. if you're here long enough to remember when we started imposing restrictions on Hanauma Bay, everybody said, a lot of people said, well, we can't do that. You have to let people have access. But there were too many people, and they were feeding frozen peas to the fish, for goodness sakes. And somebody said we have to stop. And now it's managed. I would say not well enough, but it's managed. You have to look at a safety video before you go down there. They close the place on Tuesdays to clean it up. They put a restriction on the people. We need to look at that for Laniakea. We need to figure out how to manage the number of people at Montevili Falls. And that requires a different kind of thinking than we've had before.
On the peas, I had a friend actually was at Hanauma Bay, and a parrotfish, an uhu, came up, and she was trying to feed the little fish some peas, and the parrotfish took a bite out of her knee and left a huge scar. So it's that kind of thing. It's like, how much is too much?
One other quick follow-up. I've done some work internationally, and we do have this constitution. We do have people who have rights. I've worked on some stuff in Morocco and Singapore and other places which are a little more authoritarian. And when you talk about Philippines, they can close an island. We can't do that. So we have to figure out how to do it within the model that we have. And that requires a little bit of creative thinking, but it's possible. I would argue it's possible.
And Martha?
Yeah, I think that it would be wise for Hawaii to look at some what's going on in some of the other places around the world. For instance, in both the U.S. And Canadian Park Services, National Park Services, there is a lot of concern about over-tourism, and they're moving to try to get ahead of the problem. I mean, it's already a problem in some parks, but basically they are looking at traffic management, at advanced reservations, a number of things that it seems to me could be useful here. And the other thing, just in my few days here, sort of observations, but it does seem to me that there is also a lot of cities are grappling with the short-term rentals, and there's a lot of legislation out there now that could provide some models for here. I mean, I'm really quite kind of surprised that Oahu doesn't have real legislation in place around the short-term rentals.
Right. All you have to do is Google and see the other cities that have said no, we're banning Airbnb or VRBO.
Well, either they're licensing or the owner has to be in the property that is being rented, or one place in Italy, they're not letting any rentals go for seafront properties, only for places that don't have any view of the ocean, and, keep the good places for the locals. That makes sense to me. And there's just a whole variety of different measures that are out there that could provide some real instruction for how to handle things here.
Catherine, when Frank mentioned the need for management, and certainly that's true, the need for management, I recall, I'm going to speak about Hawaii Tourism Authority, HTA. HTA was intended to be the center of gravity for tourism, but their forerunner, which was the Hawaii Visitors Bureau, the mission was really clear. It was 100% marketing. That was up front. It was a membership organization. It worked really well. But then in the 70s, 80s, complaints began to rise. The legislature, even though the tourism was a major industry for Hawaii, didn't even have a committee on tourism at all until the complaints started to come in. And then HTA, the dialogue on that was HTA was supposed to be an agency that not only dealt with marketing, but it was supposed to begin to address a lot of the other issues in anticipation of tourism. And it started out good. It was the Hawaii Strategic State Plan that came out with 9 objectives. And those 9 objectives were reflected in the HTA budget. One of the objectives was marketing. The other 8 had to do with the environment, had to do with Hawaiian culture and all of those. So that it was a good start. It was a really well intended. And as the years went by, the other objectives seemed to disappear off the allocation plate until we're now done 180. We've come clear circle. So now it looks to me, the optic is that HTA is all about marketing. So if you are part of a recipient of HTA money, as I understand it today, you need to kind of show on how whatever it is in the grant that you get, and I may be wrong, I stand to be corrected, you have to show that it's somehow connected to selling an airline seat or a hotel room.
I did happen to bring the mission of the Hawaii Tourism Authority, and this is from the original statute, and it's still there to this day. Strategically manage Hawaii's tourism in a sustainable manner consistent with economic goals, community desires, and visitor industry needs. There ain't nothing wrong with that. So why hasn't that happened? Paul Brubaker, Jim Mack, who's an emeritus professor of economics, and I have written a paper. We concluded there are really three reasons that the mission has not been accomplished. The Hawaii Tourism Authority doesn't have authority. You know, if you look at how tourism is managed, it's compartmentalized across county, state, federal, NGO, private sector, and nobody's coordinating this thing. And Hawaii Tourism Authority doesn't have the authority to undertake that management. And the second is resources. You know, when we talk about managing tourism apart from marketing, the heritage of marketing was HVCB, and that's been something that we know how to do. How do we manage sites like Montevili Falls, Laniakea? That's going to take some money, and we just haven't spent the money on it. And the third thing is a long-range plan, because some of these issues like vacation rentals have been lingering for, 30 years, and some of the other issues like homelessness are really, in the resort areas, are really tricky problems that are going to take some time to solve. So we need a long-range state plan that coordinates all these different agencies to deal with it. I did some work in Singapore. They have a 25-year plan.
And you had mentioned that maybe there needs to be a tourism czar.
Well, in this paper that we wrote, we didn't get prescriptive. We said we don't want to say we have a solution. We need to do back what they did in 1998 when they created HTA, which is create a bunch of people around the table to understand the problem, to understand objectively what the problem is, and then collectively come up with a solution that works for everybody.
I endorse most of that. I'm a little bit uncertain about how we proceed. But let me take it back a little bit further. We go through these cycles of discussing this issue. It's always there at some level, but in terms of the intensity of the discussion, it has risen and fallen. And what I remember, particularly in the 80s, which was a time of intense, especially in the neighbor islands, just intense growth. In the 80s, that phenomenon that Peter and Frank were talking about of more and more complaints, the legislature beginning to respond, they created something called the Tourism Impact Management System. Still in the books, as far as I know. And this was before HTA. It was the impetus for the first major statewide, the first time that people kind of listened to residents by doing a statewide resident survey. I got to do it. I got to design it and analyze it. But then the 90s came. The 90s was a period of stagnation. And that whole movement just kind of died away. The HTA came about not because of, even though it had the impetus from that tourism impact management thing about managing the destination, and that language got rolled into originally some of the HTA stuff, but it came out of that time of stagnation. And a lot of the law for HTA still does say that a special emphasis is going to be given to promotion and marketing. And it does say all those other things as well. Then in the early 2000s, we had another big spurt in visitor growth. Temporarily, 2001 put it down for a while, but it came back strong. That led to the carrying capacity study and the sustainable tourism study, in which you guys and I was all so involved. And then that hit the Great Recession, and that talk all kind of died down. We are now having this wave of discussion again. I'll tell you, though, that most economists believe we're going to have a recession in the next year or two, and tourism is already softening. I don't know whether temporarily or not, but the last quarter, last year was a fantastic boom year, but the last quarter, not so much, and it got worse and worse every month. I'm really waiting to see what things are going to be like. So I am very interested whether right now we are going to remember that even if tourism dies down and the emphasis again goes on getting people here, that this issue is going to come back again too.
Right. We know how vulnerable we are, whether it's SARS or a natural disaster, you know, a tsunami, a giant earthquake or lava. We're in this very vulnerable position. And Martha, you know, I don't know if there's anything you can add about, you know, what needs to work or what's worked in other places that you've studied.
Well, I think there are a number of things that are working. I mean, I do think that with a softening of the economy, there is going to be less tourism, but it doesn't mean that some of the impetus behind what is driving over tourism is not still there. I mean, a large growing middle class and cheap air flights, et cetera, are still there. So I think we're going to be continuing to face the problem. I think that Iceland is very interesting. It was good that you were able to visit there because they are grappling with over-tourism in part by trying to disperse the tourists. I mean, it's mainly around the capital, Reykjavik, it's my understanding, has been the main problem. And so they're developing routes that will send people to different parts of the island and also expanding the season. So they're trying to make it year-round tourism and really promote winter stays in Iceland. And so I think that's definitely part of the solution in a number of countries to look for where tourism is less and try to disperse it. They're doing that in the Mediterranean, also trying to find smaller towns that aren't as well known as Barcelona and Venice and so on, and have tours go there. I think tour operators are extremely important in this because they, in a way, are sort of bearing the brunt of disgruntled tourists who go to places and say, oh, it was way too overcrowded. And so they're really taking the initiative in many ways to look for other routes, other places to send tourists and so on.
You know, Catherine, interesting that, I mean, there are so many bright people working on this, but they're in different places, working on different pieces of it. It's the blind man and the elephant. And what's lacking in large part is coordination and planning and management. If you haven't read the Kauai tourism plan, the county plan, it actually says we want fewer visitors. And in talking to some people, here's a frustration. They said they want fewer visitors, but the Department of Transportation is building more air capacity into Kauai. And people are saying, wait a second, aren't you guys talking to each other? And that's a real problem. People are not coordinating their efforts. They're not talking to each other. They're not looking at a master plan. And that's we're going to still have this hodgepodge unless we figure out how to create a new model.
And my mentor, George Conelli, was one of my mentors, and he came up with an interesting template, management template, that he called the guest host place triangle. And I call it Ho'okauliki balance. And the triangle at one point is the guest, another point is the hosting community, and then the place itself. The tourism industry is in the center of the triangle. Benefits from those industries must accrue equally to all three points of the triangle. And then I know that you can't get it to balance perfectly, but as a matter of policy, if you could develop a way, an analytic system, to be able to measure that at some point as a way to kind of, you know, manage growth, that'd be kind of interesting.
That's. Let me follow up on that, because I think one big missing piece here is having the right metrics.
Yes.
The metrics so far have been, how many visitors did we get, and how many nominal dollars did we get? That drives over tourism. We need to find metrics that are related to sustainability, resident satisfaction, visitor satisfaction, real economic growth, and
amount
dispersion.
Of money that's left in the local economy. Yeah.
Those are nominally the metrics that are used. We just don't pay a lot of attention to some of those other metrics in the media, for example. I'm going to go back and again mention the concern of the long-term downturn in visitor spending and the potential reduction in taxes to pay for this, because our solutions are going to have to be a lot of Hanama Bay sort of place-specific types of controls. And we've got to pay for those. And that is, you know, I'm particularly interested in what that long-term plan is for paying for it. And the HTA is now talking about changing their emphasis from marketing to destination management. But the question, as you point out, is what they have the authority and the ability actually to do. A lot of the reactions to the impacts that we're concerned about are things that require cross-agency consultation and coordination. And it's not clear how, under our present system, that's going to happen. Who's going to be the czar? Perhaps it's a governor. Perhaps it's a mayor. You've got to get the county sitting at the table, too. So it is that beyond HTA and the paying for it that are the really big questions in my mind.
And don't forget the money. It's going to cost some money. I mean, if you're going to manage something, it's going to cost money.
Exactly.
Right, and I think the concern is managing the resource. Like, Peter, you mentioned, you know, the natural resource. You've got to protect that because that's our golden egg. You know, if the landscape is ruined.
One thing about islands, you know, islands are small. You can make huge 50, 100-acre mistakes in Arizona or California, and, you know, eventually it'll all go away. You make a 100-acre mistake in Hawaii, and you can't turn it back. There's no way to recapture lost sense of place. Waikiki is way past a sense of place, I think. So,
you know, there's a very good book by Stanley Plogue, and it's dated a little bit now, but he's got a chapter. It's called Leisure Marketing, a Travel Guide, or something like that. But he's got a chapter in there called Why Destinations Decline and Fall and Nobody Does Anything About It. And it's because the visitor experience begins to decline. And when the visitor experience begins to decline, people say it's not worth it, so they don't want to spend so much. If they don't spend so much, there's less money in the economy, and you go into this vicious cycle. And what he shows is that there's a correlation between visitor experience and actual real return on investment. So we need to pay attention to the visitor experience.
Yeah, and not to, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to dumb anything, but the model we have now, the original model was you get off the boat. It was before big numbers in it. You get off the boat, and you'd land, and you go to a hotel. There were only two here, Royal Hawaiian. And then the way you found out what was going on is you went out in the street, and you talked to local people, and they would tell you, you know, where to go, what to do. Okay? So the host and the hosted were connected. Since then, there's this huge wall of commerce that has separated the host in Hawaii. I don't know about other models. Separated the host from the hosted. So for one to access the other, you got to be able to penetrate that wall and somehow hook up. And that I think that is one of the fundamental challenges we have. How do we get back to allowing local people to honestly express themselves to a visitor in a way that is that you don't have all this stuff in between.
Yes. Peter, you talked about the boat. And Martha, if I could get you to talk about this, because I saw in Paris at Monet's Garden, it was just overrun with tourists. They had like three or four cruise ships in town. And it was just crazy. You could barely get a picture of the gardens without people, you know, traipsing all over. So what have you seen across the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those kinds of problems, I mean, it's not everywhere, but it's, you know, it's been in particular places, and I think that that's a problem. I mean, one very specific issue, which goes back to the airlines, but also to the cruise lines, is that port authorities and airport authorities are not controlled by the cities that are nearest them. And so, for instance, in Barcelona, they have this great plan, but the port authority, which brings in the cruise ships, is continuing to put in more piers and to bring in more cruise ships and to increase the numbers and so on, and the city has no control over it. So they can have the best master plan they want for the city, but it doesn't control either the airport or the port. And I think that is clearly an issue that you have to look at here in terms of at least the airports.
I did some work in Morocco, and they have a king. And it actually is a pretty good model. And maybe it's a tourism czar that we need, but they were developing this resort area in the Western Sahara, and they just said, we're going to do it here, and we're going to do it this way, and it happened. Here we do have these separated silos of decision-making, and that's where you get the issue in Kauai, where the DOT doesn't know what KVB is doing, and KVB wants this, and the county wants that, and, you know, that's where people get frustrated.
Well, in the United States, it's really almost an anomaly, because in most countries where tourism is a really important sector, there is a Ministry of Tourism, and we don't even have a National Secretary of Tourism. It's just buried in the Commerce Department. and then it's handled by the state. So we really don't have, you know, national leadership on tourism, or even, as you're saying, consolidated sort of state leadership. And tourism is such an important industry in the United States, and particularly in the coastal areas.
When HTA was created, it was it's not a department, but it was meant to be at the level of a department, but it never was. It never, ever was. And so in a place where tourism is such an important part of the economy, we don't have somebody at the highest level that's paying attention to this, that has purview over all the, or connection with, or coordination with all the other agencies that touch tourism. That's a big issue.
It's a tricky thing, because on the one hand, there's this sense of resentment that all of us sometimes have about this sense in the resident surveys that this island is run more for tourists at the expense of local people. That is something that has to be watched. And yet the solutions really require a whole lot of government attention that could easily kind of tip over into that perception of, well, they're running it for the tourists and not for us. So it's a fine line to walk.
But that's why you need a state strategic plan that is not just a focused on tourism. It really needs all the stakeholders around the table. You need the residents, you need the policymakers, you need the industry, and figure out how to create a model that, as Peter says, is balanced among all those different interests.
And the communication process is critical in that, because I so often over the decades have perceived people in the industry who have all sorts of legitimate points to make about the economic importance of tourism and how this place is going to kind of fall apart if we don't have it. But the industry tends to say, don't you understand? Don't you understand? And people don't listen always. And coming back is, don't you understand what the impacts are? Don't you understand that I am seeing somebody across the street in the hippie van for me? There's not enough listening. Somebody, the process, when we did in that sustainable tourism study, the working group that Peter and Frank and Annette were all involved in, we had a series of like 15 sessions, and the first four or five of them were yelling at each other. And after the yelling at each other calmed down, then people started to listen to each other. But it does not happen fast and furious.
Well, I think we've got about 5 minutes left, but I know we've got some, I think, lawmakers in the House. Are there any questions that you would like to pose to some of our policy members out there? I know, Frank, you had tried to bend the governor's ear on a number of things, but anybody else?
I'd just like to put a plug in, because we... A year ago, a group of us said, things are pretty broken and we need to look at how to fix them. And we've now written a white paper, Jim Mack, Paul Brubaker, who's an economist, and I, and is posted at UHERO's website. UHERO is the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. So it's uhero.hawaii.edu, and it's in a tab called Products. And I wish we had 2 hours to talk about this, but we tried to make it succinct, so...
Okay. And Martha, what do you think our policymakers should be thinking? Any questions for them?
Well, I guess I do have some questions, but it may be out of naivete. I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, as I said before, things like why the issue of the short-term rentals hasn't been addressed in terms of policies.
We see lots of heads nodding in the audience. Peter?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I do believe that the new administration at HTA has got the right heart, and I think they're headed in the right direction. The signals that are coming out now are very good. But they can only go so far without being authorized by the state legislature and or the government administration. So the leadership has got to, this state has to take responsibility for tourism and not just hand it off to HTA, because they need help too in figuring this all out, especially in the question of resources. And how do you pay for stuff? So I hope the two will come together and that there will be a heightened sense of responsibility on the part of the legislature in working with HTA to create this great, better management program.
So whether it's managing vacation rentals, something's got to happen soon.
Yes.
I'm a researcher. I went through grad school. In grad school, you learn that more research is always needed. And I believe it. I believe one of the things that is important to do before we make a plan about how to manage is to do some research about what has worked well in other areas. We are very isolated out here. We tend to draw upon our past, our gut feelings, one another's statements, and those are better be part of the mix politically. But if we don't have some solid factual basis, for example, that was the first time I ever learned for certain that things have been going down in terms of spending in similar destinations. And that's important knowledge. If we were unique, that would say, that's one thing. We better find out what's wrong with us. But structural changes are happening in this industry, exactly. Is what I'm suspecting.
Exactly.
And we don't
know
enough about them here.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're broadcasting a Zocalo Public Square event discussing over-tourism in Hawaii. It's a dilemma that we're facing. Certainly 10 million visitors this year, possibly more. That's a lot to think about. We've got additional lift with Southwest coming in. A lot of times we look at airlines and say, what are they bringing to the islands? What types of tourists are coming in? Are there new jobs? There are different challenges ahead of us. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 if you have a position to share about the subject, or write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we take a look at the Protestant work ethic.
This was one of the most influential theses in the social sciences, but also one of the most controversial ones.
Also, if you work in an office, there's a good chance it's an open one. And you love your open office, don't you?
I was contacted by a number of friends about their deep, deep emotional scarring.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
Low Viscous brings a digressive take on bluegrass to the Atherton on March 2nd. Guitarist Gabriel Smith, mandolinist Kate Ellis, and fiddler Megan Aho share their vocal harmonies and their love of old-time Appalachian music. Tickets for Low Viscous at hprtickets.org or by calling the station during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. HPR helped to start a conversation about over-tourism in Hawaii last week. We've been listening to what the Zocalo Public Square panelists had to say on the question of how much tourism is too much. We concluded by giving the audience members a chance to ask their own questions.
It's hard to figure out where to start with an issue like this. I would like to provide a little bit of context. One, Hawaii's not ran for the tourists at the expense of the locals. It is ran for the big companies at the expense of the locals and the tourists. The other one is Diamond Head. Simple solution why you saw that many people on Christmas Day is every other attraction was closed. Hanuma Bay, Pearl Harbor, Dole Pineapple Plantation. Some of this stuff is common sense when you take a step back and you look at the environment around it. So my question to you guys is, I understand lawmakers get paid to make laws. Is there any plan on enforcing any of these laws when it regards specifically to tourism operators, which I am one, or vacation rentals? There's a lot of laws out there, and there is literally zero enforcement of places like Laniakea, Waimanalo. Tour buses aren't supposed to be stopping at these places anyways.
Yeah. So just to reiterate, it's not enough to have the rules. We actually have to enforce them. Yeah.
And enforcement costs money.
Hello, my name is Ali Yamashita. My question is, what do you think if we had a solution with the government working together for people who come to visit to be inclusive in planting trees and gardens? Because everybody wants an experience now. They don't want to just buy and buy and buy because it's no longer rewarding. They want to contribute.
There are some organizations, even now, without worrying about the model and the structure and everything, that are attempting to marry tourism with sustainability. There's a Hawaii Ecotourism Association. They're working with the creation of certified guides. There's an organization called Travel to Change, which is a platform to connect visitors who want to do things with the projects that they can do. I think that's something that you're going to see more and more of.
And Martha, you know a lot about ecotourism.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say that I've come to become convinced that sustainability or responsible travel is no longer a lifestyle choice or something that can be dabbled in by a fringe part of the tourism industry. It has to be mainstreamed, and it has to be we can't continue to travel the way we have been. We've got to figure out how to do it sustainably. And I think your question goes to part of that. I mean, for instance, we take the whole growth since 2008 of this explosion of Airbnb. I mean, it was supposed to be the sharing economy. It's become big business, and it's become driven by Silicon Valley and so on, and it's corrupted. There was a need. They were playing on a real human need for wanting to have real interactions. Here, more and more, you're just staying in some place that has been rented. You never see the owner. You never have any interaction. They have multiple places that they're renting and so on. It's a corruption of the original concept. And I think that, with some controls and some legal boundaries on it, it can go back to being much more of the kind of intimate tourism that, frankly, a lot of tourists want. That's a growing, huge growing sector of the market. And Hawaii is absolutely positioned to capture that market, and you should be going after it, because these are the people who want to learn about Hawaiian culture. They want to see the beauty of the place. They want to, really experience what Hawaii has that is so special. They're the ones who are going to leave more money, come back, tell their neighbors about it, and so on. They're going to be the ambassadors for Hawaii, and those are the kinds of tourists. But that takes planning. It takes management to figure out how to capture that, how to build the structures here to appeal to those people, and then how to capture that market.
My name is Anthony Alto. Thank you for your comments this evening. If I may say so, I think you kind of dodged the question. The question is, how much tourism is too much? I'd like to suggest that 10 million is too much. But my question to you is, why are we not considering hard limits on the number of tourists who can visit?
Part of the answer to that is that it comes back to that pesky constitution. You're talking about a different government, a different model. There are some things that we can do that can sort of guide the management. But when you say, can we cap it at 10 million, that's in the United States system with our form of government. It's just, I wish it were possible, but it's difficult to do. It's difficult to do directly.
It is ultimately about management, but I do think that there is something to numbers, and part of the solution, for instance, in Barcelona is to say no new hotels and no more B&Bs in the city center. In Dubrovnik, they have limited the number of cruise tourists that can be in the old city on a day. So there are some, but it's part of a broader management plan. And so I think that just to say for Hawaii to say, first of all, we're hearing we can't do it legally, but if it could be done legally, just cap it at 10 million and do nothing else would not necessarily solve the problems. You would still have too many people on some of the beaches and some of the sites and so on. You need to have a much more holistic approach to it. I mean, numbers can be a piece of it, but it's not the whole solution.
Thank you. I'm so honored to have the last question. I'm Barbara Tanabe. My question is, we started out talking about we should improve the quality of the visitor. We want more of a strong quality economic impact. And at one time, there was discussion about diversified tourism, medical tourism, sports tourism, educational tourism. What happened to all that?
Nothing. I don't think anyone... It comes back to the euphoria that we had over growth. Everybody was so happy that we set records year after year that nobody seriously looked at the need. I mean, people talked about diversifying tourism. Paul Brubaker and I, who are co-authors on this paper, he said, well, you've talked about better tourists and higher yield tourists forever. And it's going to take all of us to come to that conclusion, to get around the table and say, enough is enough. We can't. It's not the Hawaii of 20 or 30 years ago. It's the Hawaii of 2019 with 10 million visitors who are causing problems in these areas and not pulling their weight when it comes to the economy. So it's time to have that conversation and actually make something happen.
You know, Barbara, you bring up a really interesting question that is not only applicable to tourism, but there are a whole bunch of other areas where for years, decades, we've had the right words in place, legislation, public policy. One of those areas, the whole energy thing. 35 years ago, we're talking about, converting non-fossil, blah, get rid of that. And it's only now that we're actually starting to do something about it. So I think across the board, as an island state, we've said a lot of good things. We just need to act on it. Do something.
There was a time when there was this sort of tacit, underground, unofficial statement that, okay, we've reached it because we're not going to approve any more resorts. And there haven't been any major new resorts approved since then. But this thing called the internet came along. And then this thing called Airbnb came along. So every time that you think about how you are going to accomplish this, you can accomplish it perhaps for a while given your current circumstances, and then you have to have some kind of system that's going to respond and be able to, as the business model changes, as the world changes, as technology changes. And with respect to the other guy, I don't think we've been dodging the question. I think we've been thinking about it very hard for 30 or 40 years.
Let's do something about it.
A very big round of applause for our panelists tonight. Thank you so much.
If you want to watch the entire discussion, we'll have a link for video posted on hawaiipublicradio.org. And tomorrow on The Conversation, our news director, Bill Dorman, sits down with Philippine journalist Maria Ressa. Ressa was named one of Time Magazine's 2018 Persons of the Year. She's a frequent critic and target of Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them all on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.